like an automaton, and with a face contorted with bitter grief, she began, without a word, beating her breast with her fist. They carried the coffin past her. Nina pressed her lips to her brother's for the last time as they bore the coffin by her. As Alyosha went out of the house, he begged the landlady to look after those who were left behind, but she interrupted him before he'd finished.
"To be sure, I'll stay with them. We are Christians, too."
The old woman wept as she said it. They had not far to carry the coffin to the church, not more than 300 paces. It was still a clear day with a slight frost. The church bells were still ringing. Snegiryov ran, fussing and distracted, after the coffin in his short, old summer overcoat, with his head bare and his soft, old, wide-brimmed hat in his hand. He seemed in a state of bewildered anxiety. At one minute he stretched out his hand to support the head of the coffin, and only hindered the bearers. At another he ran alongside and tried to find a place for himself there. A flower fell on the snow and he rushed to pick it up, as though everything in the world depended on the loss of that flower.
"And the crust of bread, we've forgotten the crust!"
he cried suddenly in dismay. But the boys reminded him at once that he'd taken the crust of bread already, and that it was in his pocket. He instantly pulled it out and was reassured.
"Ilusha told me to, Ilusha!"
he explained at once to Alyosha.
"I was sitting by him one night and he suddenly told me, 'Father, when my grave is filled up, crumple a piece of bread on it so that the sparrows may fly down. I shall hear, and it will cheer me up not to be lying alone.'"
"That's a good thing," said Alyosha. "We must often take some."
"Every day, every day,"
said the captain quickly, seeming cheered at the thought. They reached the church at last and set the coffin in the middle of it. The boys surrounded it and remained reverently standing so all through the service. It was an old and rather poor church. Many of the icons were without settings, but such churches are the best for praying in. During the Mass, Snegiryov became somewhat calmer, though at times he had outbursts of the same unconscious and, as it were, incoherent anxiety. At one moment he went up to the coffin to set straight the cover or the wreath. When a candle fell out of the candlestick, he rushed to replace it and was a fearful time fumbling over it. Then he subsided and stood quietly by the coffin with a look of blank uneasiness and perplexity. After the epistle, he suddenly whispered to Alyosha, who was standing beside him, that the epistle had not been read properly, but did not explain what he meant. During the prayer, like the cherubim, he joined in the singing, but did not go on to the end. Falling on his knees, he pressed his forehead to the stone floor and lay so for a long while. At last came the funeral service itself, and candles were distributed. The distracted father began fussing about again, but the touching and impressive funeral prayers moved and roused his soul. He seemed suddenly to shrink together and broke into rapid, short sobs, which he tried at first to smother, but at last he sobbed aloud. When they began taking leave of the dead and closing the coffin, he flung his arms about as though he would not allow them to cover Ilusha, and began greedily and persistently kissing his dead boy on the lips. At last they succeeded in persuading him to come away from the step. But suddenly he impulsively stretched out his hand and snatched a few flowers from the coffin. He looked at them and a new idea seemed to dawn upon him, so that he apparently forgot his grief for a minute. Gradually he seemed to sink into brooding and did not resist when the coffin was lifted up and carried to the grave. It was an expensive one in the churchyard close to the church. Katerina Ivanovna had paid for it. After the customary rites, the grave diggers lowered the coffin. Snegiryov, with his flowers in his hands, bent down so low over the open grave that the boys caught hold of his coat in alarm and pulled him back. He did not seem to understand fully what was happening. When they began filling up the grave, he suddenly pointed anxiously at the falling earth and began trying to say something, but no one could make out what he meant, and he stopped suddenly. Then he was reminded that he must crumble the bread, and he was awfully excited, snatched up the bread and began pulling it to pieces and flinging the morsels on the grave.
"Come, fly down, birds, fly down, sparrows," he muttered anxiously.
One of the boys observed that it was awkward for him to crumble the bread with the flowers in his hands, and suggested he should give them to someone to hold for a time, but he would not do this, and seemed indeed suddenly alarmed for his flowers, as though they wanted to take them from him altogether. And after looking at the grave, and, as it were, satisfying himself that everything had been done and the bread had been crumbled, he suddenly, to the surprise of everyone, turned, quite composedly even, and made his way homewards. But his steps became more and more hurried. He almost ran. The boys and Alyosha kept up with him. "The flowers are for Mama! The flowers are for Mama! I was unkind to Mama, but—" he began, exclaiming suddenly. Someone called to him to put on his hat, as it was cold, but he flung the hat in the snow as though he were angry, and kept repeating, "I won't have the hat! I won't have the hat!" Smurov picked it up and carried it after him. All the boys were crying, and Kolya, and the boy who discovered about Troy, most of all. Though Smurov, with the captain's hat in his hand, was crying bitterly too, he managed, as he ran, to snatch up a piece of red brick that lay on the snow of the path, to fling it at the flock of sparrows that was flying by. He missed them, of course, and went on crying as he ran. Halfway, Snegiryov suddenly stopped, stood still for half a minute as though struck by something, and suddenly, turning back to the church, ran towards the deserted grave. But the boys instantly overtook him and caught hold of him on all sides. Then he fell helpless on the snow, as though he'd been knocked down, and struggling, sobbing and wailing, he began crying out, "Ilusha, old man, dear old man!" Alyosha and Kolya tried to make him get up, soothing and persuading him. "Captain, give over. A brave man must show fortitude," muttered Kolya. "You'll spoil the flowers," said Alyosha, "and Mama is expecting them. She's sitting crying, because you would not give her any before. Ilusha's little bed is still there."
"Yes, yes, Mama,"
Snegiryov suddenly recollected.
"They'll take away the bed, they'll take it away,"
he added, as though alarmed that they really would. He jumped up and ran homewards again. But it was not far off, and they all arrived together. Chapter 7. A Young Man Bent on a Career. Alyosha helped Father Zosima to his bedroom and seated him on his bed. It was a little room furnished with the bare necessities. There was a narrow iron bedstead with a strip of felt for a mattress. In the corner, under the icons, was a reading desk with a cross and the gospel lying on it. The elder sank exhausted on the bed. His eyes glittered and he breathed hard. He looked intently at Alyosha as though considering something.
"Go, my dear boy, go. Porphyry is enough for me. Make haste, you are needed there. Go and wait at the Father Superior's table."
"Let me stay here,"
Alyosha entreated. "You are more needed there. There is no peace there. You will wait and be of service. If evil spirits rise up, repeat a prayer. And remember, my son," the elder liked to call him that, "this is not the place for you in the future, when it is God's will to call me. Leave the monastery, go away for good."
Alyosha started.
"What is it? This is not your place for the time. I bless you for great service in the world. Yours will be a long pilgrimage, and you will have to take a wife, too. You will have to bear all before you come back. There will be much to do, but I don't doubt of you, and so I send you forth. Christ is with you. Do not abandon him, and he will not abandon you. You will see great sorrow, and in that sorrow you will be happy. This is my last message to you. In sorrow, seek happiness. Work. Work unceasingly. Remember my words, for although I shall talk with you again, not only my days, but my hours are numbered."
Alyosha's face again betrayed strong emotion. The corners of his mouth quivered.
"What is it again?"
Father Zosima asked, smiling gently.
The worldly may follow the dead with tears, but here we rejoice over the father who is departing. We rejoice and pray for him. Leave me. I must pray. Go, and make haste. Be near your brothers, and not near one only, but near both.
Father Zosima raised his hand to bless him. Alyosha could make no protest, though he had a great longing to remain. He longed, moreover, to ask the significance of his bowing to Dmitri. The question was on the tip of his tongue, but he dared not ask it. He knew that the elder would have explained it unasked if he thought fit. But evidently it was not his will. That action had made a terrible impression on Alyosha. He believed blindly in its mysterious significance. Mysterious, and perhaps awful. As he hastened out of the hermitage precincts to reach the monastery in time to serve at the Father Superior's dinner, he felt a sudden pang at his heart and stopped short. He seemed to hear again Father Zosima's words, foretelling his approaching end. What he had foretold so exactly must infallibly come to pass. Alyosha believed that implicitly. But how could he be left without him? How could he live without seeing and hearing him? Where should he go? He had told him not to weep and to leave the monastery. Good God, it was long since Alyosha had known such anguish. He hurried through the copse that divided the monastery from the hermitage, and, unable to bear the burden of his thoughts, he gazed at the ancient pines beside the path. He had not far to go, about 500 paces. He expected to meet no one at that hour, but at the first turn of the path he noticed Rakitin. He was waiting for someone.
"Are you waiting for me?" asked Alyosha, overtaking him. "Yes," grinned Rakitin. "You are hurrying to the Father Superior. I know he has a banquet. There's not been such a banquet since the Superior entertained the Bishop and General Pyatov. Do you remember? I shan't be there, but you go and hand the sauces. Tell me one thing, Alexei. What does that vision mean? That's what I want to ask you."
"What vision?"
"That bowing to your brother, Dmitri, and didn't he tap the ground with his forehead, too?"
"You speak of Father Zosima?"
"Yes, of Father Zosima. Tap the ground."
"Ah, an irreverent expression.
Well, what of it? Anyway, what does that vision mean?"
"I don't know what it means, Misha."
"I knew he wouldn't explain it to you. There's nothing wonderful about it, of course, only the usual holy mummery. But there was an object in the performance. All the pious people in the town will talk about it and spread the story throughout the province, wondering what it meant. To my thinking, the old man really has a keen nose. He sniffed a crime. Your house stinks of it."
"What crime?"
Rakitin evidently had something he was eager to speak of.
"It'll be in your family, this crime, between your brothers and your rich old father. So, Father Zosima flopped down to be ready for what may turn up. If something happens later on, it'll be, 'Ah, the holy man foresaw it, prophesied it.' Though it's a poor sort of prophecy, flopping like that. 'Ah, but it was symbolic,' they'll say, 'an allegory.' And the devil knows what all, it'll be remembered to his glory. He predicted the crime and marked the criminal. That's always the way with these crazy fanatics. They cross themselves at the tavern and throw stones at the temple. Like your elder, he takes a stick to a just man and falls at the feet of a murderer."
"What crime? What murderer? What do you mean?"
Alyosha stopped dead. Rakitin stopped too.
"What murderer? As though you didn't know, I'll bet you've thought of it before. That's interesting too, by the way. Listen, Alyosha, you always speak the truth, though you've always been between two stools. Have you thought of it or not? Answer."
"I have,"
answered Alyosha in a low voice. Even Rakitin was taken aback.
"What? Have you really?" he cried.
I've not exactly thought it,"
muttered Alyosha. "But directly you began speaking so strangely, I fancied I had thought of it myself."
"You see? And how well you expressed it. Looking at your father and your brother Mitch today, you thought of a crime. Then I'm not mistaken."
But wait. Wait a minute,"
Alyosha broke in uneasily.
"What has led you to see all this? Why does it interest you? That's the first question."
"Two questions, disconnected but natural. I'll deal with them separately. What led me to see it? I shouldn't have seen it if I hadn't suddenly understood your brother Dmitri. Seen right into the very heart of him all at once.
I caught the whole man from one trait. These very honest but passionate people have a line which mustn't be crossed. If it were, he'd run at your father with a knife. But your father's a drunken and abandoned old sinner who can never draw the line. If they both let themselves go, they'll both come to grief.
No, Monsieur, no, if that's all, you've reassured me it won't come to that. But why are you trembling?
Let me tell you, he may be honest, your Monsieur. He is stupid but honest, but he's
a sensualist. That's the very definition and inner essence of him.
It's your father's handed him on his low sensuality. Do you know, I simply wonder at you, Alyosha, how you can have kept your purity. You're a Karamazov too, you know. In your family, sensuality is carried to a disease. But now these three sensualists are watching one another with their knives in their belts. The three of them are knocking their heads together, and you may be the fourth.
You're mistaken about that woman. Dmitri despises her, said Alyosha with a sort of shudder.
Grushenka? No, brother, he doesn't despise her, since he has openly abandoned his betrothed for her. He doesn't despise her.
There's something here, my dear boy, that you don't understand yet. A man will fall in love with some beauty, with a woman's body, or even with a part of a woman's body. A sensualist can understand that. And he'll abandon his own children for her, sell his father and mother and his country, Russia, too. If he's honest, he'll steal. If he's humane, he'll murder. If he's faithful, he'll deceive. Pushkin, the poet of women's feet, sung of their feet in his verse. Others don't sing their praises, but they can't look at their feet without a thrill, and it's not only their feet. Contempt's no help here, brother, even if he did despise Grushenka. He does, but he can't tear himself away.
I understand that.
Alyosha jerked out suddenly. Really? Well, I dare say you do understand, since you blurted out at the first word, said Rakitin malignantly. That escaped you unawares, and the confession's the more precious. So, it's a familiar subject. You've thought about it already, about sensuality, I mean. Oh, you virgin soul, you're a quiet one, Alyosha. You're a saint, I know, but the devil only knows what you've thought about and what you know already. You are pure, but you've been down into the depths.
Snegiryov opened the door hurriedly and called to his wife, with whom he'd so cruelly quarrelled just before.
Mama, poor crippled darling, Ilusha has sent you these flowers, he cried, holding out to her a little bunch of flowers that had been frozen and broken while he was struggling in the snow. But at that instant he saw in the corner by the little bed Ilusha's little boots, which the landlady had put tidily side by side. Seeing the old, patched, rusty-looking stiff boots, he flung up his hands and rushed to them, fell on his knees, snatched up one boot, and pressing his lips to it, began kissing it greedily, crying,
Ilusha, old man, dear old man, where are your little feet?
Where have you taken him away? Where have you taken him?
The lunatic cried in a heart-rending voice. Nina, too, broke into sobs. Kolya ran out of the room. The boys followed him. At last, Alyosha, too, went out.
Let them weep, he said to Kolya. It's no use trying to comfort them just now. Let us wait a minute and then go back.
No, it's no use. It's awful, Kolya assented. Do you know Karamazov?
He dropped his voice so that no one could hear them.
I feel dreadfully sad, and if it were only possible to bring him back, I'd give anything in the world to do it.
Ah, so would I, said Alyosha.
What do you think, Karamazov? Had we better come back here tonight? He'll be drunk, you know.
Perhaps he will.
Let us come together, you and I. That will be enough. To spend an hour with them, with the mother and Nina. If we all come together, we shall remind them of everything again, Alyosha suggested.
The landlady's laying the table for them now. There'll be a funeral dinner or something. The priest is coming. Shall we go back to it, Karamazov?
Of course, said Alyosha.
It's all so strange, Karamazov. Such sorrow and then pancakes after it. It all seems so unnatural in our religion. They're going to have salmon, too,
the boy who had discovered about Troy observed in a loud voice.
I beg you most earnestly, Kartazov, not to interrupt again with your idiotic remarks.
especially when one is not talking to you and doesn't care to know whether you exist or not. Collier snapped out irritably. The boy flushed crimson but did not dare to reply. Meantime, they were strolling slowly along the path, and suddenly Smurov exclaimed, "There's Ilusha's stone under which they wanted to bury him." They all stood still by the big stone. Alyosha looked, and the whole picture of what Snegiryov had described to him that day, how Ilusha, weeping and hugging his father, had cried, "Father, father, how he insulted you," rose at once before his imagination. A sudden impulse seemed to come into his soul. With a serious and earnest expression, he looked from one to another of the bright, pleasant faces of Ilusha's schoolfellows, and suddenly said to them, "Boys, I should like to say one word to you here, at this place." The boys stood round him and at once bent attentive and expectant eyes upon him. "Boys, we shall soon part. I shall be for some time with my two brothers, of whom one is going to Siberia and the other is lying at death's door. But soon I shall leave this town, perhaps for a long time, so we shall part. Let us make a compact, here, at Ilusha's stone, that we will never forget Ilusha and one another. And whatever happens to us later in life, if we don't meet for 20 years afterwards, let us always remember how we buried the poor boy at whom we once threw stones. Do you remember, by the bridge? And afterwards we all grew so fond of him. He was a fine boy, a kind-hearted, brave boy. He felt for his father's honour and resented the cruel insult to him and stood up for him. And so, in the first place, we will remember him, boys, all our lives. And even if we are occupied with most important things, if we attain to honour or fall into great misfortune, still let us remember how good it was once here when we were all together, united by a good and kind feeling which made us, for the time we were loving that poor boy, better perhaps than we are. My little doves, let me call you so, for you are very like them, those pretty blue birds, at this minute as I look at your good, dear faces. My dear children, perhaps you won't understand what I'm saying to you, because I often speak very unintelligibly, but you'll remember it all the same and will agree with my words sometimes. You must know that there is nothing higher and stronger and more wholesome and good for life in the future than some good memory, especially a memory of childhood, of home. People talk to you a great deal about your education, but some good, sacred memory preserved from childhood is perhaps the best education. If a man carries many such memories with him into life, he is safe to the end of his days. And if one has only one good memory left in one's heart, even that may sometime be the means of saving us. Perhaps we may even grow wicked later on, may be unable to refrain from a bad action, may laugh at men's tears and at those people who say, as Collier did just now, "I want to suffer for all men," and may even jeer spitefully at such people. But however bad we may become, which God forbid, yet when we recall how we buried Ilusha, how we loved him in his last days, and how we've been talking like friends all together at this stone, the cruelest and most mocking of us, if we do become so, will not dare to laugh inwardly at having been kind and good at this moment. What's more, perhaps, that one memory may keep him from great evil, and he will reflect and say, "Yes, I was good and brave and honest then." Let him laugh to himself. That's no matter. A man often laughs at what's good and kind. That's only from thoughtlessness. But I assure you, boys, that as he laughs, he will say at once in his heart, "No, I do wrong to laugh, for that's not a thing to laugh at." "That will be so, I understand you, Karamazov," cried Kolya with flashing eyes. The boys were excited, and they too wanted to say something, but they restrained themselves, looking with intentness and emotion at the speaker. "I say this in case we become bad," Alyosha went on. "But there's no reason why we should become bad, is there, boys? Let us be, first and above all, kind, then honest, and then let us never forget each other. I say that again. I give you my word for my part that I'll never forget one of you. Every face looking at me now I shall remember even for 30 years. Just now Kolya said to Kartashov that we did not care to know whether he exists or not, but I cannot forget that Kartashov exists, and that he is not blushing now as he did when he discovered the founders of Troy, but is looking at me with his jolly, kind, dear little eyes. Boys, my dear boys, let us all be generous and brave like Ilusha, clever, brave, and generous like Kolya, though he will be ever so much cleverer when he's grown up. And let us all be as modest, as clever, and sweet as Kartashov. But why am I talking about those two? You're all dear to me, boys, from this day forth. I have a place in my heart for you all, and I beg you to keep a place in your hearts for me. Well, and who has united us in this kind, good feeling, which we shall remember and intend to remember all our lives? Who, if not Ilusha, the good boy, the dear boy, precious to us forever? Let us never forget him. May his memory live forever in our hearts from this time forth. Yes, yes, forever, forever, the boys cried in their ringing voices with softened faces. Let us remember his face and his clothes and his poor little boots, his coffin and his unhappy, sinful father, and how boldly he stood up for him alone against the whole school. We will remember, we will remember, cried the boys. He was brave, he was good. Ah, how I loved him, exclaimed Kolya. Ah, children, our dear friends, don't be afraid of life. How good life is when one does something good and just. Yes, yes, the boys repeated enthusiastically. Karamazov, we love you, a voice, probably Kartashov's, cried impulsively. We love you. We love you, they all caught it up. There were tears in the eyes of many of them. Hurrah for Karamazov, Kolya shouted ecstatically. And may the dear boy's memory live forever, Alyosha added again with feeling. Forever, the boys chimed in again. Karamazov, cried Kolya. Can it be true what's taught us in religion, that we shall all rise again from the dead, and shall live and see each other again? All? Ilusha too? Certainly we shall all rise again, certainly we shall see each other, and shall tell each other with joy and gladness all that has happened. Alyosha answered, half laughing, half enthusiastic. Ah, how splendid it will be, broke from Kolya. Well, now we will finish talking and go to his funeral dinner. Don't be put out at our eating pancakes. It's a very old custom and there's something nice in that, laughed Alyosha. Well, let's go. And now we go hand in hand. And always so, all our lives hand in hand. Hurrah for Karamazov! Kolya cried once more rapturously, and once more the boys took up his exclamation. Hurrah for Karamazov! This concludes the reading of The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. This book was read by Frederick Davidson. If you would like to obtain a mail-order catalogue or additional information about our growing line of audiobooks, write Blackstone Audiobooks, Post Office Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Thank you. I've been watching you for a long time. You're a Karamazov yourself. You're a thorough Karamazov. No doubt birth and selection have something to answer for. You're a sensualist from your father, a crazy saint from your mother. Why do you tremble? Is it true, then? Do you know, Grushenka has been begging me to bring you along. I'll pull off his cassock, she says. You can't think how she keeps begging me to bring you. I wonder why she took such an interest in you. Do you know she's an extraordinary woman, too? Thank her and say I'm not coming, said Alyosha with a strained smile. Finish what you were saying, Misha. I'll tell you my idea after. Well, there's nothing to finish. It's all clear. It's the same old tune, brother. If even you are a sensualist at heart, what of your brother Ivan? He's a Karamazov, too.
What is at the root of all you Karamazovs is that you're all sensual, grasping, and crazy. Your brother Ivan writes theological articles in joke for some idiotic, unknown motive of his own, though he's an atheist, and he admits it's a fraud himself. That's your brother Ivan. He's trying to get Mitch's betrothed for himself, and I fancy he'll succeed, too. And what's more, it's with Mitch's consent, for Mitchell will surrender his betrothed to him to be rid of her, and escape to Grushenka. And he's ready to do that in spite of all his nobility and disinterestedness. Observe that. Those are the most fatal people. Who the devil can make you out? He recognizes his vileness and goes on with it. Let me tell you, too, the old man, your father, is standing in Mitch's way now. He has suddenly gone crazy over Grushenka. His mouth waters at the sight of her. It's simply on her account he made that scene in the cell just now, simply because Miusov called her an abandoned creature. He's worse than a tomcat in love. At first she was only employed by him in connection with his taverns and in some other shady business, but now he has suddenly realized all she in and has gone wild about her. He keeps pestering her with his offers, not honorable ones, of course, and they'll come into collision, the precious father and son, on that path. But Grushenka favors neither of them. She's still playing with them and teasing them both, considering which she can get most out of. For though she could filch a lot of money from the papa, he wouldn't marry her, and maybe he'll turn stingy in the end and keep his purse shut. That's where Mitya's value comes in. He has no money, but he's ready to marry her. Yes, ready to marry her, to abandon his betrothed, a rare beauty, Katerina Ivanovna, who's rich and the daughter of a colonel, and to marry Grushenka, who has been the mistress of a dissolute old merchant, Samsonov, a coarse, uneducated provincial mayor. Some murderous conflict may well come to pass from all this, and that's what your brother Ivan is waiting for. It would suit him down to the ground. He'll carry off Katerina Ivanovna, for whom he's languishing, and pocket her dowry of 60,000. That's very alluring to start with for a man of no consequence and a beggar. And, take note, he won't be wronging Mitya, but doing him the greatest service. For I know, as a fact, that Mitya, only last week, when he was with some gypsy girls drunk in a tavern, cried out aloud that he was unworthy of his betrothed Katya, but that his brother Ivan, he was the man who deserved her. And Katerina Ivanovna will not in the end refuse such a fascinating man as Ivan. She's hesitating between the two of them already. And how has that Ivan won you all so that you all worship him? He's laughing at you and enjoying himself at your expense.
How do you know? How can you speak so confidently?
Alyosha asked sharply, frowning.
Why do you ask and are frightened at my answer? It shows that you know that I'm speaking the truth.
You don't like Ivan. Ivan wouldn't be tempted by money.
Really? And the beauty of Katerina Ivanovna?
It's not only the money, though a fortune of 60,000 is an attraction.
Ivan is above that. He wouldn't make up to anyone for thousands. It's not money, it's not comfort Ivan is seeking. Perhaps it's suffering he is seeking.
What wild dream now, oh you aristocrats!
Ah, Misha, he has a stormy spirit. His mind is in bondage. He is haunted by a great unsolved doubt. He's one of those who don't want millions but an answer to their questions.
That's plagiarism, Alyosha. You're quoting your elders' phrases.
Ah, Ivan has set you a problem, cried Rakitin
with undisguised malice. His face changed and his lips twitched.
And the problem's a stupid one. It is no good guessing it. Rack your brains, you'll understand it. His article is absurd and ridiculous. And did you hear his stupid theory just now? If there's no immortality of the soul, then there's no virtue and everything is lawful. And, by the way, do you remember how your brother Mitya cried out, I will remember. An attractive theory for scoundrels. I'm being abusive, that's stupid. And not for scoundrels, but for pedantic poseurs, haunted by profound, unsolved doubts. He's showing off, and what it all comes to is, on the one hand we cannot but admit, and on the other it must be confessed. His whole theory is a fraud. Humanity will find in itself the power to live for virtue even without believing in immortality. It will find it in love for freedom, for equality, for fraternity. Rakitin could hardly restrain himself in his heat, but suddenly, as though remembering something, he stopped short. Well, that's enough, he said with a still more crooked smile. Why are you laughing? Do you think I'm a vulgar fool?
No, I never dreamed of thinking you a vulgar fool. You are clever, but... Never mind, I was silly to smile. I understand you're getting hot about it, Misha. I guess from your warmth that you're not indifferent to Katerina Ivanovna yourself. I've suspected that for a long time, brother. That's why you don't like my brother, Ivan. Are you jealous of him? And jealous of her money, too, won't you add that?
I'll say nothing about money. I'm not going to insult you.
I believe it since you say so, but confound you, and your brother Ivan with you. Don't you understand that one might very well dislike him apart from Katerina Ivanovna? And why the devil should I like him? He condescends to abuse me, you know. Why haven't I a right to abuse him?
I never heard of his saying anything about you, good or bad. He doesn't speak of you at all.
But I heard that the day before yesterday at Katerina Ivanovna's he was abusing me for all he was worth. You see what an interest he takes in your humble servant. And which is the jealous one after that, brother, I can't say. He was so good as to express the opinion that if I don't go in for the career of an archimandrite in the immediate future, and don't become a monk, I shall be sure to go to Petersburg and get on to some solid magazine as a reviewer. That I shall write for the next 10 years, and in the end become the owner of the magazine, and bring it out on the liberal and atheistic side, with a socialistic tinge, with a tiny gloss of socialism. But keeping a sharp lookout all the time, that is, keeping in with both sides and hoodwinking the fools. According to your brother's account, the tinge of socialism won't hinder me from laying by the proceeds, and investing them under the guidance of some Jew, till at the end of my career I build a great house in Petersburg, and move my publishing offices to it, and let out the upper stories to lodgers. He's even chosen a place for it, near the new stone bridge across the Neva, which they say is to be built in Petersburg.
Ah, Misha, that's just what will really happen, every word of it, cried Alyosha, unable to restrain a good-humoured smile.
You're pleased to be sarcastic too, Alexei Fyodorovich.
No, no, I'm joking. Forgive me. I've something quite different on my mind. But excuse me, who can have told you all this? You can't have been at Katerina Ivanovna's yourself when he was talking about you.
I wasn't there, but Dmitri Fyodorovich was, and I heard him tell it with my own ears. If you want to know, he didn't tell me, but I overheard him, unintentionally, of course, for I was sitting in Grushenka's bedroom and I couldn't go away, because Dmitri Fyodorovich was in the next room.
Oh, yes, I'd forgotten she was a relation of yours.
A relation? That Grushenka, a relation of mine? Cried Rakitin, turning crimson. Are you mad? You're out of your mind.
Why, isn't she a relation of yours? I heard so.
Where can you have heard it? You Karamazovs brag of being an ancient noble family, though your father used to run about playing the buffoon at other men's tables, and was only admitted to the kitchen as a favour. I may be only a priest's son and dirt in the eyes of noblemen like you, but don't insult me so lightly and wantonly. I have a sense of honour too, Alexei Fyodorovich. I couldn't be a relation of Grushenka, a common harlot. I beg you to understand that.
Rakitin was intensely irritated.
Forgive me, for goodness sake, I had no idea. Besides, how can you call her a harlot? Is she that sort of woman?
Alyosha flushed suddenly.
I tell you again, I heard that she was a relation of yours. You often go to see her, and you told me yourself you're not her lover. I never dreamed that you, of all people, had such contempt for her. Does she really deserve it?
I may have reasons of my own for visiting her. That's not your business. But as for relationship, your brother or even your father is more likely to make her yours than mine.
Well, here we are. You'd better go to the kitchen. Hello, what's wrong? What is it? Are we late? They can't have finished dinner so soon. Have the Karamazovs been making trouble again? No doubt they have. Here's your father and your brother Ivan after him. They've broken out from the Father Superior's. And look, Father Isidore's shouting out something after them from the steps. And your father's shouting and waving his arms. I expect he's swearing. Bah! And there goes Miusov driving away in his carriage. You see, he's going. And there's old Maximov running. There must have been a row. There can't have been any dinner. Surely they've not been beating the Father Superior. Or have they perhaps been beaten? It would serve them right.
There was reason for Rakitin's exclamations. There had been a scandalous and unprecedented scene. It had all come from the impulse of a moment.
Chapter 8. The Scandalous Scene. Miusov, as a man of breeding and delicacy, could not but feel some inward qualms when he reached the Father Superior's with Ivan. He felt ashamed of having lost his temper. He felt that he ought to have disdained that despicable wretch, Fyodor Pavlovich, too much to have been upset by him in Father Zosima's cell, and so to have forgotten himself. The monks were not to blame in any case, he reflected on the steps, and if they're decent people here, and the Father Superior, I understand, is a nobleman, why not be friendly and courteous with them? I won't argue. I'll fall in with everything. I'll win them by politeness and show them that I have nothing to do with that Aesop, that buffoon, that Pierrot, and have merely been taken in over this affair, just as they have. He determined to drop his litigation with the monastery and relinquish his claims to the wood-cutting and fishery rights at once. He was the more ready to do this because the rights had become much less valuable, and he had indeed the vaguest idea where the wooden river in question were. These excellent intentions were strengthened when he entered the Father Superior's dining-room, though, strictly speaking, it was not a dining-room, for the Father Superior had only two rooms altogether. They were, however, much larger and more comfortable than Father Zosima's. But there was no great luxury about the furnishing of these rooms, either. The furniture was of mahogany, covered with leather, in the old-fashioned style of 1820. The floor was not even stained. But everything was shining with cleanliness, and there were many choice flowers in the windows. The most sumptuous thing in the room at the moment was, of course, the beautifully decorated table. The cloth was clean, the service shone. There were three kinds of well-baked bread, two bottles of wine, two of excellent mead, and a large glass jug of kvass, both the latter made in the monastery and famous in the neighbourhood. There was no vodka. Rakitin related afterwards that there were five dishes: fish soup made of sterlets, served with little fish patties, then boiled fish served in a special way, then salmon cutlets, ice pudding and compote, and finally blancmange. Rakitin found out all about these good things, for he could not resist peeping into the kitchen, where he already had a footing. He had a footing everywhere and got information about everything. He was of an uneasy and envious temper. He was well aware of his own considerable abilities, and nervously exaggerated them in his self-conceit. He knew he would play a prominent part of some sort, but Alyosha, who was attached to him, was distressed to see that his friend Rakitin was dishonourable, and quite unconscious of being so himself, considering, on the contrary, that because he would not steal money left on the table, he was a man of the highest integrity. Neither Alyosha nor anyone else could have influenced him in that. Rakitin, of course, was a person of too little consequence to be invited to the dinner, to which Father Yosef, Father Paisi, and one other monk were the only other inmates of the monastery invited. They were already waiting when Miusov, Kalganov, and Ivan arrived. The other guest, Maximov, stood a little aside, waiting also. The Father Superior stepped into the middle of the room to receive his guests. He was a tall, thin, but still vigorous old man, with black hair streaked with grey, and a long, grave, ascetic face. He bowed to his guests in silence, but this time they approached to receive his blessing. Miusov even tried to kiss his hand, but the Father Superior drew it back in time to avoid the salute. But Ivan and Kalganov went through the ceremony in the most simple-hearted and complete manner, kissing his hand as peasants do. "We must apologize most humbly, Your Reverence," began Miusov, simpering affably and speaking in a dignified and respectful tone. "Pardon us for having come alone without the gentleman you invited, Fyodor Pavlovich. He felt obliged to decline the honor of your hospitality, and not without reason. In the Reverend Father Zosima's cell he was carried away by the unhappy dissension with his son, and let fall words which were quite out of keeping, in fact, quite unseemly, as—" He glanced at the monks. "Your Reverence is no doubt already aware, and therefore, recognizing that he had been to blame, he felt sincere regret and shame, and begged me and his son, Ivan Fyodorovich, to convey to you his apologies and regrets. In brief, he hopes and desires to make amends later. He asks your blessing and begs you to forget what has taken place. As he uttered the last words of his tirade, Miusov completely recovered his self-complacency, and all traces of his former irritation disappeared. He fully and sincerely loved humanity again. The Father Superior listened to him with dignity, and with a slight bend of the head, replied, "I sincerely deplore his absence. Perhaps at our table he might have learnt to like us, and we him. Pray be seated, gentlemen." He stood before the holy image and began to say grace, aloud. All bent their heads reverently, and Maximov clasped his hands before him, with peculiar fervour. It was at this moment that Fyodor Pavlovich played his last prank. It must be noted that he really had meant to go home, and really had felt the impossibility of going to dine with the Father Superior as though nothing had happened, after his disgraceful behaviour in the elder's cell. Not that he was so very much ashamed of himself, quite the contrary, perhaps, but still he felt it would be unseemly to go to dinner. Yet his creaking carriage had hardly been brought to the steps of the hotel, and he had hardly got into it, when he suddenly stopped short. He remembered his own words at the elder's. "I always feel when I meet people that I'm lower than all, and that they all take me for a buffoon. So I say, let me play the buffoon, for you are, every one of you, stupider and lower than I." He longed to revenge himself on everyone for his own unseemliness. He suddenly recalled how he'd once in the past been asked, "Why do you hate so-and-so so much?" And he had answered them, with his shameless impudence, "I'll tell you, he had done me no harm, but I played him a dirty trick, and ever since I've hated him." Remembering that now, he smiled quietly and malignantly, hesitating for a moment. His eyes gleamed and his lips positively quivered. "Well, since I have begun, I may as well go on," he decided. His predominant sensation at that moment might be expressed in the following words. "Well, there is no rehabilitating myself now, so let me shame them for all I'm worth. I'll show them I don't care what they think. That's all." He told the coachman to wait, while with rapid steps he returned to the monastery and straight to the Father Superior's. He had no clear idea what he would do, but he knew that he could not control himself, and that a touch might drive him to the utmost limits of obscenity. But only to obscenity, to nothing criminal, nothing for which he could be legally punished. In the last resort he could always restrain himself, and had marvelled indeed at himself on that score sometimes. He appeared in the Father Superior's dining room at the moment when the prayer was over and all were moving to the table. Standing in the doorway, he scanned the company and, laughing his prolonged, impudent, malicious chuckle, looked them all boldly in the face. "They thought I'd gone, and here I am again," he cried to the whole room. For one moment everyone stared at him without a word, and at once everyone felt that something revolting, grotesque, positively scandalous, was about to happen. Miusov passed immediately from the most benevolent frame of mind to the most savage. All the feelings that had subsided and died down in his heart revived instantly. "No, this I cannot endure," he cried. "I absolutely cannot, and I certainly cannot." The blood rushed to his head. He positively stammered, but he was beyond thinking of style, and he seized his hat. "What is it he cannot?" cried Fyodor Pavlovich. "That he absolutely cannot and certainly cannot. Your Reverence, am I to come in or not? Will you receive me as your guest?" "You are welcome with all my heart," answered the Superior. "Gentlemen," he added, "I venture to beg you most earnestly to lay aside your dissensions and to be united in love and family harmony, with prayer to the Lord at our humble table." "No, no, it's impossible!" cried Miusov beside himself. "Well, if it is impossible for Pyotr Alexandrovich, it is impossible for me, and I won't stop. That is why I came. I will keep with Pyotr Alexandrovich everywhere. Now, if you will go away, Pyotr Alexandrovich, I will go away too. If you remain, I will remain.
You stung him by what you said about family harmony, Father Superior. He does not admit he is my relation. That's right, isn't it, Vanzone? Here's Vanzone. How are you, Vanzone?
Do you mean me?
Muttered Maximoff, puzzled.
Of course I mean you, cried Fyodor Pavlovich. Who else? The Father Superior could not be Vanzone.
But I'm not Vanzone either, I am Maximoff.
No, you are Vanzone, your reverence. Do you know who Vanzone was? It was a famous murder case. He was killed in a house of harlotry. I believe that is what such places are called among you. He was killed and robbed, and in spite of his venerable age, he was nailed up in a box and sent from Petersburg to Moscow in the luggage van. And while they were nailing him up, the harlots sang songs and played the harp, that is to say, the piano. So this is that very Vanzone. He's risen from the dead, hasn't he, Vanzone?
What is happening? What's this?
Voices were heard in the group of monks.
Let us go, cried Miusov, addressing Kalganov. No, excuse me, Fyodor Pavlovich broke in shrilly, taking another step into the room. Allow me to finish. There in the cell you blame me for behaving disrespectfully just because I spoke of eating gudgeon, Pyotr Alexandrovich. Miusov, my relation, prefers to have plus de noblesse, que de sincérité, in his words. But I prefer in mine plus de sincérité que de noblesse, and damn the noblesse. That's right, isn't it, Vanzone? Allow me, Father Superior, though I am a buffoon and play the buffoon, yet I am the soul of honour, and I want to speak my mind. Yes, I am the soul of honour, while in Pyotr Alexandrovich there is a wounded vanity and nothing else. I came here perhaps to have a look and speak my mind. My son Alexei is here, being saved. I am his father. I care for his welfare, and it is my duty to care. While I've been playing the fool, I have been listening and having a look on the sly. And now I want to give you the last act of the performance. You know how things are with us. As a thing falls, so it lies. As a thing once has fallen, so it must lie forever. Not a bit of it. I want to get up again. Holy Father, I'm indignant with you. Confession is a great sacrament before which I'm ready to bow down reverently. But there, in the cell, they all kneel down and confess aloud. Can it be right to confess aloud? It was ordained by the Holy Fathers to confess in secret. Then only your confession will be a mystery, and so it was of old. But how can I explain to him, before everyone, that I did this and that? Well, you understand what. Sometimes it would not be proper to talk about it. So it is really a scandal. No, fathers, one might be carried along with you to the flagellants, I dare say. At the first opportunity I shall write to the synod, and I shall take my son Alexei home.
We must note here that Fyodor Pavlovich knew where to look for the weak spot. There had been at one time malicious rumours which had even reached the archbishop. Not only regarding our monastery, but in others, where the institution of elders existed, that too much respect was paid to the elders, even to the detriment of the authority of the superior, that the elders abused the sacrament of confession, and so on, and so on, absurd charges which had died away of themselves, everywhere. But the spirit of folly which had caught up Fyodor Pavlovich, and was bearing him on the current of his own nerves into lower and lower depths of ignominy, prompted him with this old slander. Fyodor Pavlovich did not understand a word of it, and he could not even put it sensibly, for on this occasion no one had been kneeling and confessing aloud in the elder's cell, so that he could not have seen anything of the kind. He was only speaking from confused memory of old slanders. But as soon as he had uttered his foolish tirade, he felt he had been talking absurd nonsense, and at once longed to prove to his audience, and above all to himself, that he'd not been talking nonsense. And, though he knew perfectly well that with each word he would be adding more and more absurdity, he could not restrain himself and plunged forward blindly.
"How disgraceful!" cried Pyotr Alexandrovich. "Pardon me," said the Father Superior. "It was said of old, many have begun to speak against me and have uttered evil sayings about me. And hearing it, I have said to myself, it is the correction of the Lord, and he has sent it to heal my vain soul.
And so, we humbly thank you, honored guest."
And he made Fyodor Pavlovich a low bow.
"Tut, tut, tut. Sanctimoniousness and stock phrases, old phrases and old gestures, the old lies and formal prostrations. We know all about them. A kiss on the lips and a dagger in the heart, as in Schiller's Robbers. I don't like falsehood, fathers. I want the truth. But the truth is not to be found in eating gudgeon, and that I proclaim aloud. Father monks, why do you fast? Why do you expect reward in heaven for that? Why, for a reward like that, I will come and fast too. No, saintly monk, you try being virtuous in the world. Do good to society without shutting yourself up in a monastery at other people's expense, and without expecting a reward up loft for it. You'll find that a bit harder. I can talk sense too, Father Superior. What have they got here?" He went up to the table. "Oh, port wine, mead, brewed by the Alessayev brothers. Fie, fie, fathers, that is something beyond gudgeon. Look at the bottles the fathers have brought out. And who has provided it all? The Russian peasant, the labourer, brings here the farthing earned by his horny hand, wringing it from his family and the tax-gatherer. You bleed the people, you know, holy fathers."
"This is too disgraceful," said Father Yosef.
Father Paisi kept obstinately silent. Miusov rushed from the room, and Kalganov after him.
"Well, Father, I will follow, Pyotr Alexandrovich. I'm not coming to see you again. You may beg me on your knees. I shan't come. I sent you 1,000 rubles, so you have more. I'm taking my revenge for my youth, for all the humiliation I endured."
He thumped the table with his fist in a paroxysm of simulated feeling.
"This monastery has played a great part in my life. It has cost me many bitter tears. You used to set my wife, the crazy one, against me. You cursed me with bell and book. You spread stories about me all over the place. Enough, fathers. This is the age of liberalism, the age of steamers and railways. Neither 1,000 nor 100 rubles, no, nor 100 farthings, will you get out of me."
It must be noted again that our monastery never had played any great part in his life, and he never had shed a bitter tear owing to it. But he was so carried away by his simulated emotion that he was for one moment almost believing it himself. He was so touched he was almost weeping. But at that very instant he felt that it was time to draw back. The Father Superior bowed his head at his malicious lie and again spoke impressively.
"It is written again, bear circumspectly and gladly dishonour that cometh upon thee by no act of thine own. Be not confounded and hate not him who hath dishonoured thee. And so will we. Tut, 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 bethinking thyself and the rest of the rigmarole. Bethink yourselves, fathers, I will go, but I will take my son, Alexei, away from here forever, on my parental authority. Ivan Fyodorovich, my most dutiful son, permit me to order you to follow me. Fonson, what have you to stay for? Come and see me now in the town. It is fun there. It's only one short verst. Instead of Lenten oil, I'll give you sucking pig and kasha. We will have dinner with some brandy and liqueur to it. I've cloud berry wine. Hey, Vonzon, don't lose your chance."
He went out shouting and gesticulating. It was at that moment Rakitin saw him and pointed him out to Alyosha.
"Alexei!" his father shouted from far off, catching sight of him. "You come home to me today for good and bring your pillow and mattress and leave no trace behind."
Alyosha stood rooted to the spot, watching the scene in silence. Meanwhile, Fyodor Pavlovich had got into the carriage, and Ivan was about to follow him in grim silence without even turning to say goodbye to Alyosha. But at this point, another, almost incredible scene of grotesque buffoonery gave the finishing touch to the episode. Maximov suddenly appeared by the side of the carriage. He ran up, panting, afraid of being too late. Rakitin and Alyosha saw him running. He was in such a hurry that in his impatience he put his foot on the step on which Ivan's left foot was still resting,
and clutching the carriage, he kept trying to jump in.
"I'm going with you,"
he kept shouting, laughing a thin, mirthful laugh with a look of reckless glee in his face.
"Take me, too."
"There," cried Fyodor Pavlovich, delighted. "Did I not say he was Von Sohn? It is Von Sohn himself, risen from the dead. Why, how did you tear yourself away? What did you, Von Sohn, there? And how could you get away from the dinner? You must be a brazen-faced fellow."